welcome to the third episode of the Mail Mysteries podcast. I'm your host, Mail Mystery. I thought I'd do something a little different this time. I've decided to dedicate this entire show to Yule and the pagan origins of Christmas. I'll come back to more gay pagan-themed topics next month, including wrapping up the Eros, Hermes, Heracles, Trinity. This episode, I'll talk about the pagan origins of Christmas. We'll pose the question, is Santa Claus really Satan, as some fundamentalist Christian churches believe? And if not, who is he really? I'll share my list to Santa. Co-host Track will talk more on Christmas's pagan and mythic origins, and if all goes well, there will be some royalty-free, secular, and pagan-esque Christmas music from eMusic.com. It really depends on whether I'm able to import the files into my podcast software. I'll be leaving out my own holiday trip to see my folks and sister bright and early in the morning, so at this point I'm rushing frantically to get this podcast together so I can publish it before leaving. Oh, and my friend David, aka Nightshade, was going to do a review of a quasi-pagan holiday called Moosemus, but the tape he did had some awful hissing noises in it. No doubt the traditional Moosemus snakes. Without stealing his topic, I'll just say this for those of you who are wondering what Moosemus is. It's celebrated every year the day after Thanksgiving on Black Friday as a protest against the commercialism of the holidays. My friends celebrate it by sitting back and watching cheesy movies, sometimes including Rocky and Bullwinkle, and chanting the traditional hymn, Owa Tammuz Siam. Say that really fast a dozen times and you'll get the point. Anyway, without further ado, here's this month's show.
Rats. Nobody sent me a Christmas card today. I almost wish there weren't a holiday season. I know nobody likes me. Why do we have to have a holiday season to emphasize it?
I've had some letters come in about my new podcast, and I just thought I'd take a moment to share them with you. This one is from R. Poole on the Gay Druid Brotherhood. Hey Mel, you're a handsome man. Looks like we have a lot in common too. Why, thank you. Send me your photo and particulars, and we'll chat more. This one is from Chris. Hey Mel, I love the podcast. I'm a grad student in comparative sociology, and your ideas sing to me. They are well-researched and quite poignant. I wanted to add that Lucemi, a.k.a. Santeria, welcomes gays and lesbians and does not have the same hang-ups about sexuality. In fact, many of the Orishas are androgynous or bisexual. You must include Joseph Campbell on the use of Greek myths, which find their way into Christianity. The goddess Persephone is the one, along with Hermes, that leaves and returns to Hades. This concept, according to Campbell, is where Christians get the concept of resurrection, since Persephone must return to Hades seasonally, thus explaining death, winter, and resurrection, spring. Keep up the amazing and well-needed work. Warm regards, Chris. I'm glad you like the show, Chris. I'll have to do a future episode on Santeria, as well as on Joseph Campbell. I'd love to hear more on your perspectives on these two topics. Perhaps you could post some information about both topics on the Mail Mysteries Yahoo group. If you go to my webpage, there's a link to join there. This one is from Silver Wolf. Mel, I much enjoyed your show. We really need to have more shows for gay pagan men. We're such a subgroup of a subgroup. If I wanted to make a donation to help out your show, how could I do this? Silver Wolf. Well, Mr. Wolf, I'm glad you like the show enough to want to contribute. I feel funny right now about accepting cash donations to the show. I guess I just want to get it established a bit first. I'll probably end up changing my mind at some point, since better software, promotions, research materials, and so forth cost money. In the meantime, there are a few ways you can contribute. 1. I put a wish list of books related to gay and bi pagan spirituality on my website. If you'd like to donate any of these, it would help provide material for future shows. Just contact me by email to work out the details. 2. I do a bit of amateur photography. I'm not sure it's anything spectacular, but I have gotten some relatively cute guys to pose, mostly in swimsuits and boxers, but there are a few nudes, too. If you purchase a one-time, one-month subscription, the money goes to me, and you get some photos of hunky guys in return. You can go to www.matrixworks.com. That's www.matrixwerx.com. A third way you can contribute is to advertise your group, event, or business on my show or website. You'd need to come up with an audio file or graphic, but I'm only charging $10 a month, at least until I get a bigger fan base. Lastly, you can just help spread the word about the show. I'm more interested in providing great information and building a community for gay and bi pagan men than actually making any money.
Could it be Satan?
Is Santa Claus Satan? a special report concerning the origin of Santa Claus from the Landover Baptist Church, Freehold, Iowa. Satan's evil plan has created jobs for hundreds of thousands of old lecherous pedophiles throughout this godly country every December. These filthy, homeless hobos just lay on their urine-stained cardboard beds 11 months out of the year, dreaming of Christmas when they can drunkenly traipse into the warmth of department stores and have innocent little Christian children sit on their vermin-infested lap. Unwary parents happily snap pictures while Satan's obesely weaseling drunks ask their children whether they've been bad and whisper lewd suggestions in their angelic little ears with their filthy booze breath and cigarette-discolored lips. How many unsuspecting tots have suffered a quick grope before Satan's little helper moves on to the next hopeful child in line. People think that Halloween is the time of year that Satan dresses up, but this is just flat out wrong. See, the devil will always try to fool you. Halloween is when Satan delights in watching humans dress in ways that will ensure them entry into the devil's realm. But it is Christmas time that the devil saves for himself. It is then when he puts on his most devious costume, and it takes no Sherlock Holmes to see that the devil's annual disguise is none other than Santa. He even wears his favorite color, demon red. Even his last name, Claus, is Old English for hoof claws. Lucifer may be the wiliest of all deceitful demons that ever drew breath in fire and hell, but he was pretty sloppy when he decided to try to spoil our Savior's birthday with this disguise. His big devil ego got the better of him when he decided to name his Christmas Antichrist after himself. He just moved around the letters in his name, Satan, into a sonogram and got Santa. Well, this is to put Prince of Darkness on notice. We are on to you, Satan, and we unmask you and heartily rebuke you. Get thee hence from our Christ's birthday party. Satan once was God's favorite angel, but he tried a heavenly coup, and God should have by all rights killed him right then and there. But God, being all that is good, gave him his very own place to rule and called it hell. And even though God gave Satan free rein to tempt as many people as he wanted, even Christ himself, and lots of fabulous stuff to tempt them with, like eternal youth and Lincoln Continentals, Satan was still not satisfied. It made him jealous that Americans have made Christmas the most important retail event of the year, far overshadowing Satan's own holiday, Halloween. So Satan has tried to undermine Christmas by making Santa even more popular than Jesus. You don't think so? Even the law of the land forbids a baby Jesus in the town square, but who is there instead? You guessed it, Santa. Every time a so-called Christian child asks Santa for something, he is praying to Satan. With each request fulfilled, parents are unwittingly making a pact with the devil. They may as well be writing in blood, "Satan, please distract our children from Jesus with all these shiny toys." But you know what? When your little boys and little girls have grown up and no longer believe that Santa is real, they will find out just how real Satan is when he comes to collect their souls in exchange for all those presents. And God will turn a deaf ear to their pathetic wails of desperation. God will say, you were more interested in that fat demon who was giving you presents than my son who was giving you salvation. So you can all rot in hell for all I care. So talk to your children before it's too late. Tell them that Santa is no kindly old man. He is an evil demon. And next time your family sees some popped-up gin-soaked vagrant in the mall wearing a red suit with fluffy furry cuffs, set a good example and witness for the other deluded people waiting in line. Loudly rebuke him. Announce to all the children in the store, not only is Santa a lie, he will ravage you sexually, drink your blood, and drag your palpitating carcasses down to hell with him. It is only through setting a good example that we can put Christ back in Christmas. That's a special report from the Landover Baptist Church.
Well, isn't that special?
As if the evils of Santa weren't enough to deal with this holiday season, I, Mel Mystery, have uncovered yet another threat, Santa's followers, also known as Santaists. What follows is a shocking report on this cult that I found at wikipedia.org. Santaists are collaborators and sympathizers who support the evil goals of Santa Claus. Considered public threats in the nations in which they live, they lead highly secretive lives, hiding their allegiance to Santa throughout the year, emerging only during the Christmas season to terrorize their neighbors. These cultists leave presents for him in their homes in order to signify their allegiance to his cause, and are thusly spared from the yearly massacre. The term Santaist is actually a colloquial one used by those unsympathetic to Santa's goals. In the duchy, the military and propaganda services who clandestinely support worldwide Santaist cabals have traditionally called them red shirts, after the red tunics modeled after duchy military uniforms that they wear. Santaists refer to themselves as the Nice. They are often confused with Satanists, though no relationship between the two groups has ever been established. So far, there is no provable link between the Nice and the scientifically proven red shirts phenomena. The arch nemesis of the Nice are the enemies of Santa, collectively referred to as the Naughty. These fearless defenders of freedom have led the fight against Santa since the mid-1920s, and their successful repulsion of Santa's armies every year has fueled an unparalleled hatred. The catchy, intimidating songs sung by the Nice are called carols, and the practices associated with the singing of these songs, whatever differences may exist between various regions, is known as caroling. Just prior to Christmas, the Nice organize into tightly regimented mobs, and in militaristic fashion they march through local neighborhoods and enclaves known for their populations of naughty people, singing carols and often stopping at individual houses in order to sing directly to the owners. Frequently, they will provoke fights with random passerbys and commit acts of wanton vandalism against shops and businesses owned by the Naughty. In the weeks prior to the season, the Nice will mortify their flesh by exposure to cold as a means of penance. As a payment of tribute to their master, Santaists leave gifts out on Christmas Eve so that he will know that he is in the home of his follower. These gifts are meant to symbolize some event in the history of Santa's rise to power. The most commonly given gifts are milk, symbolizing the blood of the elves who first resisted Santa's rule, and cookies, symbolizing the bodies of the elven children who died along with their rebellious parents. Of course, everyone knows that cookies and milk were also the traditional food of the elves before Santa's arrival. Santa adopted these foods as his own to signify the elves' absorption into his new state, the Duchy of the Arctic Circle. Additionally, adherents may present confirmed kills from Santa's enemies, also called Naughty, during the normal year. Naughties who are murdered can be redeemed at the North Pole by their assassins for cash or a commission of officer rank in the Duchy military. On Christmas Eve, Santa's followers give these victims freely as a show of their eternal loyalty. It is currently unclear what the fate of the Nice will be, should Santa achieve his goals, though Santa researchers who have not been summarily executed by the Snowy Lord theorize some form of ghastly slavery. So there you have it. This Christmas season, beware both Santa and his followers, the Santaists.
Look, Charlie, let's face it. We all know that Christmas is a big commercial racket. It's run by a big Eastern syndicate, you know.
It's funny how every year some well-meaning Christian folk condemn Halloween as a pagan holiday, but they seem to miss the fact that Christmas, Easter, and other so-called Christian holidays actually began as pagan festivals. Back in the early days of the Catholic Church, many of the pagan festivals were still being celebrated. Try as they might, they couldn't seem to eradicate the celebrations, so instead they co-opted them and made them Christian holy days, often dedicating them to a saint, and many of the old gods were demonized to make them less popular among the people. Christmas is a good example. Many of the traditions we associate with Christmas date back hundreds, if not thousands, of years before the birth of Christ. It wasn't even until around 336 AD that the holiday was Christianized. Before that time, many cultures celebrated the winter solstice, the date around December 21st being the shortest day of the year and the darkest night. In fact, most of these festivals included some kind of sympathetic magic or ritual in hopes of bringing the sun and its warmth back to the world. Many traditions speak of either the sun god or other nature god who dies and is reborn at the winter solstice. This sun god is born at the winter solstice, and as he grows and matures, the days get warmer and longer. He reaches his peak at the summer solstice and then gradually grows old and dim in the days leading up to the winter solstice. In the Celtic tradition, there are actually two gods who compete for supremacy, the Holly King and the Oak King. The Oak King kills the Holly King at Yule and then reigns until midsummer. Then the two battle again, this time with the Holly King as the victor. These two are mortal enemies at the solstices, but they are really two sides of a whole that couldn't exist without each other. In another tradition that was popular around 320 AD, the Persian sun god Mithras was born on December 25th. Coincidence? I think not. The Roman festival of Saturnalia was celebrated at the winter solstice in honor of the god Saturn, who ruled over agriculture. The Romans decked their halls with garlands of laurel and placed candles ornaments and live trees to decorate. They may also have decorated with holly and ivy. The festival included feasts and gift giving. The Greeks celebrated the death and rebirth of Dionysus, the god of wine and ecstasy, for 12 days surrounding the winter solstice. In Scandinavia, they hung apples from evergreen trees at the winter solstice to remind themselves that spring and summer would come again. The evergreen tree was sacred to the sun god Baldur. Decorating the trees may also have been a way of making offerings to the tree's spirit. Another northern tradition involved burning a Yule log in honor of the gods and to bring good luck in the coming year. A sprig of holly may have been tossed in the fire by individuals to burn up the troubles of the past year and to keep their houses from burning down in the new year. The Yule log was made from a huge tree. A piece of it was saved to start the fire on next year's Yule log. This piece was also believed to protect the home from fire and lightning. The Druids held a winter solstice ritual that involved cutting mistletoe from an oak tree with a golden sickle and catching it in a cloth before it touched the ground. Mistletoe was considered sacred because, unlike most plants, it doesn't grow out of the earth, and in fact, it's rooted closest to the heavens. Mistletoe was considered a healing plant and was believed to ward off evil. The white berries may have been considered related to male semen, which may explain why it's also related to fertility. The Norse also held mistletoe to be special related to the goddess Frigga, the Norse goddess of love, marriage, and fertility. Her son Baldur was slain by Loki with an arrow made of mistletoe. When Baldur was restored to life, Frigga blessed the mistletoe and gave a kiss to anyone who passed under it. As for other Christmas traditions, leaving cookies and milk for Santa probably comes from the traditions in many cultures where milk and cookies were left to the weak folk, the fae, the elves, and various gods and goddesses. Santa is, after all, considered a jolly old elf. The ringing of bells was considered a way of driving away demons and ghosts that were supposed to be prevalent during the darkest time of the year. The lighting of fires, whether from a Yule log or candles, were a form of sympathetic magic to encourage and bring back the light and warmth of the sun. Evergreens were thought to have power over death because their green never faded. They were considered so powerful that they could defeat winter demons and hold back death and destruction. Wreaths symbolized the wheel of the year and the completion of another solar cycle. Scandinavians started the tradition of hanging wreaths at Yule. In Germany, a giant wreath known as St. Catherine's Wheel involves a giant four-spoked wheel with an effigy of a person that is lit on fire and rolled down a hill. This probably goes back to a tradition and time where human sacrifices were made for the return of the sun. So next time one of your Christian friends starts going off on Halloween, be sure to let them know that Christmas is also a pagan holiday.
Sometimes you have to slap them in the face.
Ow!
Slap them in the face.
Ow!
Just to get their attention.
Welcome to the edition of the podcast where we'll discuss the origins of Christmas and the wonders of the days of magic leading up to wintertime. Years ago, when life depended on the proper rounds of tilling, sowing, harvesting, and the recovery of the sun to begin each cycle anew, not only Christmas, but all the days of the winter season were filled with magic. The days were therefore devoted to rituals of the field to ensure good herds and harvest, of the hearth to protect the house, and of the fire to drive away the dark. In France and Germany, and parts of Britain, for instance, winter began on Martinmas Day, St. Martin's Day, which was November 11th, when those gifted with vision might see the saint himself riding across the meadow and the fields on his white horse with his red cape, releasing from the folds of his cloak the very first snow of the season. Martin was an early Christian saint, and so generous was he that he cut his cloak in half to warm a freezing beggar, and passed the wine cup an emperor gave him to the humblest of his priests. He was the patron saint of wine and vintners. A good person to know in a party time, I suppose. Bonfires are lighted on the eve of his day, and animals that could not be fed through the winter were slaughtered and salted down. Perhaps in memory of older winter sacrifices, their blood was sometimes sprinkled on their owners' thresholds. St. Martin's Day was one of feasting, when the first of the new wine was drunk, and in memory of his patronage, German children placed vessels of water on their doorsteps, with the plea that the water be changed to wine. On the morning of Martinmas Day, the water would indeed be wine, and beside it would lie a special cookie shaped like a horseshoe, to show that the saint had ridden by in the night. Now let's get a little closer. St. Nicholas's Day. When the old gods ruled the world, Odin, the All-Father, rode the skies of Germany in Scandinavian winter with a crowd of elves and spirits, and those mortals who offered him reverence were rewarded with gifts. In later years, Odin's horse, elves, and gifts became the accoutrements of a Christian saint named Nicholas. Nicholas lived in Asia Minor. Because he calmed storms at sea during his life, he became the patron of sailors. And because he restored to life three murdered youths, he became the patron of boys. But the most famous tale concerning him was that of three maidens whose impoverished father planned to sell them into slavery. Nicholas redeemed them with three bags of dowry gold, which he flung through the window one night, and which landed on their shoes, set to warm before the fire. For this deed he became the patron of maidens, and French women prayed to him for husbands. He also became the patron of pawnbrokers, and his bags of gold are remembered in the three golden balls that are a sign of the trade. But gift-giving was his most important act. In Germany and Holland, children set out their shoes on the eve of his feast day, filling them with hay and carrots for his white horse, just as provender had been left for Odin's horse by their ancestors. Nicholas, they knew, would ride over the rooftops in the night with his elvish companion, Necht Rupert. Rupert carried a switch for use only on naughty young ones. But Nicholas carried baskets of toys and sweets to be left in the shoes of all the good children. Following this would be the day of the solstice. From time before memory, people danced to make magic, and throughout Europe, they danced at the solstice as a defense against the dark. The recollection of those early ceremonies lived on in the form of village sword dances, performed on the shortest of days, December 21st. Clothed in elaborate ribbon costumes, men would circle sunwise from left to right, in the apparent path of the sun, using the swords they bore to form patterns in the air. The most important pattern marked the climax of the dance. It was a six-pointed star, the earthly symbol of the longed-for sun. As the solstice came into its own, Christmas Eve was a time for human feasting, and for something else. In Scandinavia, people said, the ghost of the dead returned in the night to visit the homes they had loved. Their descendants welcomed them. After the meal of the living was finished, food was left for the dead, and then the living retired so their ancestors might come into the warmth and the light to make their old Christmas revels once more. And as Christmas Eve was over and done, we come upon Christmas Day. As midnight ushered in the day of Christmas, tranquility descended on all the world, according to the old tales. Even in the darkness, all the birds awoke and sang, and such was the music of the time that sparrows caroled as sweetly as nightingales. And in the morning, men and women who walked in the wilderness of the world might see all the beasts of field and wood lying placidly together, predator and prey, joined for one day to make a peaceable kingdom. And after all the revels of Christmas, and Christmas Eve and solstice, we come upon New Year's Eve. In order that the new year might prosper, the old year and the spirits released by the solstice season had to be buried or driven away. In villages from Britain to Austria, the old year, in the form of a straw dummy called Death, was carried through the streets and then drowned in a stream, or buried or burned. All other people in other villages had more high-spirited customs. On New Year's Eve, costumed and masked as a disguise against malevolent powers, people paraded through their towns, striking the houses with sticks, beating drums, clanging bells, and cracking whips. The noise of the town rattling, as it was called, drove out the ghost of the dying old year and brought in the new year safely in. A few days after the new year, we find the 12th night. It isn't interesting to see how all these seem to fit into a pattern of old ways. The eve of the 12th day of Christmas once was a time for ensuring the health of growing things that had been sent to sleep by the winter. In the west of England on that night, farmers trooped into their orchards to take wassail, good health, to their apple trees. The apple tree, long revered for its fruit, was thought to house its own elfin spirit. With songs and shouts, the men called upon the tree to awaken from its sleep. One reveler would be masked by a bull, as a bull, symbol of fertility, and all made offerings to the tree spirits to ensure its fruitfulness. In a fork of its branches, they placed bread and salt, or sometimes a cake soaked in cider from the wassail bowl. The branches themselves are dipped in cider, are sprinkled with its own libation. And last but not least, we have Bridget's Day. The British of ancient times had a goddess of youth and fertility named Bride. Christians called her St. Bridget and celebrated her feast on February 1st. But the celebration were far older than Christianity. Bride, the folk said, was held prisoner during the dark months in the mountain of the goddess of winter, who used a silver hammer to cover the earth with ice. At the beginning of February, the young goddess was released. On the eve of the feast day in Ireland and Scotland, people set candles burning to summon the returning light of spring, which followed in Bride's footsteps. Then they placed a bed by the threshold and called a welcome into the darkness, and when morning came, they examined the ashes in the hearth, and signs of disturbance were a good omen. That meant that Bride was once more abroad in the land, and that winter had been driven away. It's interesting how they all seem to fit together so conveniently today, doesn't it?
You better be nice to me if you want your stocking stuffed.
Santa Claus. Is he St. Nicholas? Is he just an anagram of Satan? Or is he one of the old gods such as the Wild Man, Odin, Thor, Freyr, Freya, or some other pre-Christian pagan god? I'll present the theories and let you decide. St. Nicholas was a 4th century Turkish Christian bishop with a reputation for goodness, benevolence, and performing miracles. He miraculously supplied gold for 3 girls as a marriage dowry so they would not have to become prostitutes, and he brought 3 children back to life after they'd been chopped by a butcher. Notice that in both cases, the number 3, the number of manifestation, is present. But if Santa Claus is St. Nicholas, how did he end up at the North Pole driving a sleigh pulled by reindeer and fraternizing with elves? Santa may have been a pre-Christian god, such as the Wild Man, a dark city hair-covered man whose legend and mythos spread to many lands and cultures, adapting and changing as he went. Originally, this wild god reminded people of the cycles of nature, death and rebirth, and he was part of fertility performances in Europe. He was universally worshipped by pagans as Cronos, Pan, the Wild Man, the embodiment of nature. The Wild Man embodied the elements, including storms and thunder. Most of the time, he lived peacefully in solitude in the woods among the animals. But when his anger was aroused, the storms raged. But he could also be benevolent, advising and helping humans in the arts of hunting and agriculture. As part of the cycle of life, yearly he had to be killed so he could be reborn again. Otherwise, the earth would stop yielding its fruits, animals would die, and humans would die. Every year he was sacrificed in his prime as part of an annual fertility ritual. Usually the ritual included a mating between the Wild Man and a woman. As a fertility ritual and festival, all the necessary elements were in place, from huge phalluses to public intercourse, in hopes of inspiring animals to copulate, as well as to aid in human fertility. As was their custom, the early Christians demonized the old gods, so Santa and Satan may have had the same roots in this old god. They could be alter egos, brothers if you will, or flip sides of the same god. As the old gods were demonized, many converted to Christianity, but the old gods weren't to go peacefully. When the people exchanged their old gods for the Christian gods, they did so reluctantly, for they believed the old gods would swear retribution. Even as late as the 20th century, some Norwegians believed that these gods would rouse themselves to battle Christians during the Yuletide season. They believed that these old gods would come shrieking down out of the mountains on the wind and carry away any Christian foolish enough to be found outdoors. Perhaps Santa was a Norse god. That would explain why he lives at the North Pole. Maybe Santa is Odin, the Norse god of wisdom, magic, and occult knowledge. Odin was depicted as an old man with a white beard and wearing a cloak. Odin rode the skies and the seas on his fast white horse, Sleipnir. The horse had 8 legs. Odin is a mythical representation of goodness and wisdom. Odin is also considered the king of the elves, or perhaps that was Freyr. Freyr was a solar deity and a phallic fertility deity who was pulled across the skies by wild boars. He was also a god of agriculture as well as peace. Freyr was well endowed, to say the least, and sexual activity formed an important part of his worship. Although heterosexual, many of his priests were homosexual. Freyr's sister, the Norse goddess Freya, is said to spend the 12 days after the winter solstice driving a chariot pulled by stags, giving presents to the good and punishing the not so good. it. The Norse god Thor was a benevolent and protective god who was also fun-loving. He rode a chariot across the sky pulled by goats. The conversion of any of these sleigh-pulling animals to reindeer might be a tribute to Herni, the stag god. Regardless of who he is exactly, his pagan origin is obvious. He lives in the north among the elves. He has magical powers. Even his reindeer have elemental names. Donder, which is thunder, Blitzen, which is lightning, Comet, a celestial object, and what of the fertility associations with Cupid and Vixen? There's probably a lot more I can say, but I'll leave it at that for now.
See, Santa Claus doesn't need any steps, honey. He when he comes, he brings the North Pole with him, and he slides down like a fireman.
Good evening. I'd like to talk to you this evening about the origins of Christmas. Some would even say the shocking origins, the shocking pagan origins of Christmas. Although the whole world celebrates Christmas as a Christian holiday, including millions of non-Christians, is Christmas really Christian at all? Consider this fact. Look high and low throughout the pages of the Bible, and you will find not one word of Christmas being celebrated by any of the followers. It is not even mentioned once. Neither the Messiah nor any of his apostles ever observed this holiday, nor the New Testament church. Yet on the other hand, the pagan, heathen world observed this day for thousands of years before this Messiah was even born. Where did this mysterious rites and ceremonies that surround this day come from? What about the Christmas tree and the Yule log and the mistletoe? Are any of these customs truly Christian in origin? And what about that fat, jolly old Saint Nick or Santa Claus? We read in Werner Keller's book, The Bible is History, the following admission, and I quote, December 25th is referred to in the documents as Christmas Day in A.D. 324 for the very first time. Under the Roman Emperor Justinian in A.D. 527 to 565, it was recognized as an official holiday. An old Roman festival played as a major part in the choice of this particular day. December 25th in ancient Rome was the Dies Natali Invictus, the birthday of the unconquered, the day of the winter solstice, and at the same time in Rome, the last day of the Saturnalia, which had long since degenerated into a week of unbridled carnival. Doesn't it seem rather strange that this so-called Christian church should choose a day to celebrate the Messiah's birth, which was identified as the day of the birth of the unconquered sun, the day of the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year, when the sunlit part of the day start becoming longer again? And what does this have to do with the Messiah anyway? Let's take out our magnifying glass and, like Sherlock Holmes, do a little bit of careful detective work and see if we can solve the mystery of who was born on December 25th. The puzzle of why the world observes the birthday of Jesus Christ as the day on which he was not even remotely born. In the book, The History of Rome by Michael Grant, we read this startling revelation, and I quote, yet there was also another pagan belief during the same epoch that much more nearly competed with Christ for the control of the Western world. This was the cult of the sun, which was revered by millions of the inhabitants of the Roman Empire, and its religion for a time even became the state worship. Notice, Christianity took over the birthday of the sun god, the cult of the sun, and transformed it into Christmas Day, the birthday of the Messiah. It was in reality the birthday of the pagan sun god, worshipped by millions throughout the Roman Empire. But that's the way things usually work. Now we see the influence of a particular man called Constantine. When Constantine became emperor of Rome, he nominally at least became a Christian. But being the head of a far-flung political empire, he was concerned about the unity and coherence and stability of his empire. As a sagacious politician, he sought to reconcile and blend and mesh pagan practices with Christian beliefs. To merge paganism with the Roman Church, Constantine promulgated the Edict of Toleration in A.D. 313. He became emperor in A.D. 323, and then Christianity was enthroned, according to Jesse Lyman Harbert in The Story of the Christian Church. From this time, for the next 200 years, all persecutions of Christians of the Roman Church and its inheritance ceased. The sword of persecution was not merely sheathed, it was buried. But do we see that Christianity did not destroy paganism, it adopted it. The Greek mind, dying, came to a transmigrated life in the theology and liturgy of the church. The Greek mysteries passed down into the impressive mystery of the Mass. Other pagan cultures contributed to the synchronistic result. From Egypt came the idea of a living Trinity. From Egypt, the adoration of the mother and the child. From Phrygia came the worship of the Great Mother. The Mithraic ritual so closely resembled the Eucharistic sacrifice of the Mass that Christian fathers charged the devil with inventing these similarities to mislead frail minds. Christianity was the last great creation of the ancient pagan world. You see, paganism was not defeated by the church. It invaded the church, infiltrated it, and seduced it from within. The professing Christian church became the new face of paganism, and only the names have changed. And in some cases, as in Easter Sunday, even the old pagan names are left in place for Astarte. And how did this happen? How did all these changes happen? How did Mithraism, with its December 25th worship and Sunday worship, contribute with prominent holidays to the established Christian church? How did paganism overtake, overcome, and subdue the original teachings of the Church of the Messiah and his apostles and replace biblical holy days with pagan holy days? Should all true Christians be concerned about this, or does it even really matter? Alexander Hyshop wrote in his Two Babylons, "The Christmas tree, now so common among us, was equally common in pagan Rome and pagan Egypt. In Egypt, the tree was the palm tree. In Rome, it was the fir. The palm tree denoting the pagan Messiah, as Baal Tamar, the fir, referring to him as Baal Berith. The mother of Adonis, the sun god and great mediatorial divinity, was mystically said to have been changed into a tree, when in that state to have been brought forth her divine son. If the mother was a tree, the son must have been recognized as a man of the branch. And this entirety accounts for the putting of the Yule log into the fire on Christmas Eve, and the appearance of the Christmas tree the next morning." Tree worship was very common among the ancients, and the Christmas tree recapitulates the idea of tree worship, gilded nuts and balls symbolizing the sun. All the festivities of the winter solstice have been absorbed into Christmas Day. The use of holly and mistletoe to the druidic ceremonies, the Christmas tree to the honors paid to Odin's sacred fir. Mistletoe, since the earliest of times, has been regarded as a mysterious and sacred, the symbol of the sun, bestower of life, an aphrodisiac and protector against disease and poison. The plant was especially sacred to the Celtic druids, who offered it in prayer to the gods. The mistletoe was referred to by pagans as the golden bough. Two great holidays when the pagans gathered mistletoe were Midsummer Day, the summer solstice, and December 25th, the winter solstice. It was supposed to possess the power of revealing treasures of the earth and was formed into a divining rod. It was also looked upon as the seat of life of the sacred oak and as an emanation of the sun's fire. Kissing under the mistletoe is a survival of a Saturnalian sexual licentiousness and bawdy behavior, which is commonplace during Saturnalia. And then we find dear old Santa Claus. Even old Santa does not have such a benign origin. The fat and jolly elf can be traced back to another ancient pagan Norse legend, which we find in World Book Encyclopedia. Some of Santa Claus's characteristics date back many centuries. For example, the belief that Santa enters the house through the chimney developed from an old Norse legend. The Norse believed that the goddess Hertha appeared in the fireplace and brought good luck to the home. So by absorbing such pagan feasts and traditions, the Christian church could subtly bring its own theology, in this case establishing the good Saint Nicholas, bringer of love and gifts, while grudgingly allowing the presence of the old religions, Herrn or Pan, but only as a slave to Saint Nicholas. Thus, in parts of Europe, the church turned Herrn into Saint Nicholas, captive, chained, dark helper, none other than Satan, the Dark One, symbol of all evil. And so much for old Saint Nicholas. The mythological figure is pagan to the core. Once again, in Alexander Hyshop's book, The Two Babylons, he points out that the Mass is something that definitely goes back to ancient pagan customs and rites. He declares in plain and clear language, "Therefore we find the women of Judah represented as simply burning incense, pouring out drink offerings, and offering cakes to the Queen of Heaven, That's found in Jeremiah 44:19. The cakes were the unbloody sacrifice she required. In the 4th century, when the Queen of Heaven, under the name of Mary, was beginning to be worshipped in the Christian church, this unbloody sacrifice was also brought in. Ephesians states that the practice of offering and eating it began among the women of Arabia, and at the time it was well known to have been adopted from the pagans. The very shape of the unbloody sacrifice of Rome may indicate when it came. It is a small, thin, round wafer, and on its roundness the Church of Rome lays so much stress. The importance, however, when Rome attaches to the roundness of the wafer, must have a reason, and the reason will be found if we look in the altars of Egypt. The thin, round cake, says Wilkinson, occurs on all altars. Almost every jot or tittle in the Egyptian worship had a symbol meaning. The round disc, so frequent in the sacred emblems of Egypt, symbolized the sun. That Christmas was originally a pagan festival is beyond all doubt. The time of the year, the ceremonies with which it is still celebrated, prove its origin. In Egypt, the son of Isis, the Egyptian title for the Queen of Heavens, was born this very time, about the time of the winter solstice. The very name by which Christmas is popularly known among ourselves, Yule Day, proves once again its pagan and Babylonian origins. Yule is the Chaldean name for an infant or little child. And as the 25th of December was also called by our pagan Anglo-Saxon ancestors, Yule Day, or the Child's Day, and the night that preceded it was Mother Night, long before it became in contact with Christianity, that sufficiently proves its real character. So, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Have a good Yule night.
Daddy?
Yes, sugar?
Is it true that if you're a bad little kid, Santa Claus will give you a lump of coal instead of presents?
Sure is, pumpkin.
Dear Santa, I've been pretty good this year. Well, actually, too good. What I'd really like wrapped up under my tree this year is a man. As much as I'd like to unwrap one of my favorite celebrities, such as Victor Webster or Eric Johnson, I know they're in pretty high demand, so I'd be more than happy to settle for one or a few with celebrity good looks. Tall or short, I really don't care, as long as he's pretty proportional. If he's a little bit athletic, that's great, but not overly muscular. Older or younger can both be great. If he's older, he should be sexy. If he's younger, he needs to realize that I'm in charge, whether I know what I'm doing or not. I like dark-haired guys, but blondes can be fun too. I'm not hung up on eye color, but a nice smile and good skin tone would be great. Maybe a 6 o'clock shadow, but no beards or mustaches. Goatees depend on the guy. I'm not too much into the latest styles, but if he can carry off something preppy, but not too trendy, or rugged, but not too macho, or something like the guys in the Covenant movie, that would be great. I'd really like someone strong, confident, and masculine, but also tender, loving, and with a sense of humor. Oh yeah, and perhaps he could be a bit quiet and introspective, but also a bit adventurous. He'd have to be open-minded too, since I'm not your average guy. Intelligence can be sexy, but not trying too hard to impress with his knowledge. And if he's not an intellectual, that's okay too, as long as I don't have to think for him. It would be cool if he had a bit of a dark and mysterious aspect to him, but not so dark I fear to sleep at night. Really, I just don't want a wussy or someone who overly analyzes everything. It would be great if we had things in common, like paganism, science fiction, men's concerns, liking nature, and working on cars. It would be nice if he had some different interests too that would expand my horizons. If he was a bit athletic and could encourage me to exercise and diet better, that would be great, provided he doesn't condescend me when I don't. I could see us going hiking and camping, going to science fiction conventions and men's retreats, working on restoring and customizing our cars, staying in to watch television and movies, as well as going out to dinner and offbeat local attractions. Oh yeah, and we'd have common goals like plotting world domination, or at least starting that men's spiritual retreat center and spa out in the country that I've been dreaming of. He'd have to accept me where I am now in my life, while gently encouraging me towards something better. He'd have to put up with my Virgo hypochondrias and how I've been obsessing about getting everything organized in my life these days, or how I like to shower a lot. He'd have to have better than average hygiene himself if he wants to get anywhere close to me, or cuddle, or have sex, or anything like that. I've got some pretty good qualities too, like being loyal and caring. I'm pretty smart, I'm open-minded, I have pretty offbeat ideas about the world that someday people will look back on and say, wow, Mel was a visionary for his time. I'm friendly, I'm practical, I'm sometimes contradictory, which only adds to the enigma and mystery that is Mel. I steer away from drama, I'm straight acting, whatever that means, though I'm also comfortable with my sexuality. I clean up my own messes and otherwise take responsibility for myself and my actions. Santa, it would be great if you could find me a soulmate, but if that's too tricky, I'd be happy for someone who is just comfortable to be with and cute. I'm open to both serious dating and something casual, provided I like the guy. I'm even open to polyamorous-type relationships, provided everything's honest and upfront, and I get all the loving and attention I need first. So Santa, when you come down my chimney on Christmas Eve, keep in mind that this would be the best present ever you could give me. And if you don't find a compatible man in your Christmas sack, you can always give me car parts so I can get my kit car back on the road, or DVDs of my favorite movies and television shows. Thank you, Mel Mystery. That's pretty much it for this show. I had wanted to do a bit more, but it's coming down to the wire, and I still have to pack for my trip in the morning and get some other errands run. Unfortunately, I don't have the time to do a final sound quality check or to update the show notes on my website. I'll do that when I return in the new year. Anyway, Merry Yule and Happy New Year to you and yours. Thanks for listening to Discovering the Mail Mysteries with Mel Mystery podcast. You can find out more information about the show, its hosts, and find a link to our Yahoo group by going to http://melmystery.matrixwerx.com. That's http://melmystery.matrixwerx.com. If you would like to submit original poetry or music, suggest a topic, or guest host a future segment, you can find information on how to do so, including a way to email me, on the Mail Mysteries website.